Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today we're joined by Robert Kay. He is the founder of 319 Climate. He is an international climate expert. Happy to have Robert on the podcast today. Hey, Robert, welcome to the podcast. It's great to see you again.
You too, Ted.
How are you?
I'm really well. Yourself?
I'm doing good. Now, are you in Los Angeles as we speak?
I am. I'm at home in Studio City.
You know, you got to ask these days because people could be pretty much anywhere. Right? So I've already introduced you as the founder of 319 Climate, which is your new business. And I want to hear all about it. What's happening? I know now, let's see, the mission is to spearhead initiatives that foster a climate resilient, low carbon future. Could you explain your vision and what's the game plan?
All right. Well, first off, Ted, thanks. It's a privilege to be part of the EcoMotion podcast family. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, good to have you.
Ted, this came after a sort of an epiphany. It was actually a combination of events that after 10 years working in large companies doing climate change consulting here based in LA for the last 10 years, I'm thinking, okay, this is I was going through a milestone birthday as well, Ted, and thinking, okay, what can I really do with the experiences that I've had, the skills and experiences, the connections, the contacts that I've built up through my career to really, really accelerate this transition. And rather than doing that on a project by project basis, is actually thinking about, well, what can I do in a more flexible way through my own company. And that came into the title of the company. So 319 is the carbon dioxide concentration the year I was born, Ted. And I'm sure you've seen many in our community often put that on in their email block, born at. So I was born at 319. We're 421 right now. And this is unacceptable, right? And we're already in a position where we are from really 10 years, maybe 15 years ago, I stopped writing future climate change impacts into just saying climate change impacts, because that emerging signal of impact combined with this urgent need for rapid decarbonization sort of came together in my own mind of like, okay, how can I work in a more flexible way, empowering those who are really looking at systemic change by them building on sort of exemplars of good practice and saying, often, I'm sure you get this too with clients, Ted, it's like, I can't visualize that. I can't see what that looks like. And you know, being able to actually have tangible examples of change, and that can be physical examples, or it can be through governance arrangements. It could be good communities of practice that you can model on, or examples from other parts of the world that can be drawn on to say, look, actually change has happened in this place or in this community or using this example, and then actually being able to scale that in a systemic way. That's really what I'm really looking to achieve.
Interesting. And you did, like you said, 10 years of consulting, and you had fantastic roles. You were at ICF. You were the head of the climate resilience principal, California lead, and you had the mm-hmm. ICF Climate Center. You shifted over to AIRUP a couple of years ago, climate and sustainability services leader. So you feel like this new structure gives you more flexibility to focus in on what you really want to get done.
Yeah, thanks, Ted. The real thing is just being able to choose exactly what I want to do for myself. It's a selfish structure as well, Ted. You know what it's like. You get to choose your own clients. You get to choose who you want to work with, and more importantly, why you want to do that particular activity. And so the ability of being able to work for large organizations in a contract basis here in the US, as well as then being able to work internationally on international development projects as well at the same time, which often require you to be an individual consultant to be able to do that. It's just the way in which the that work is structured. So it provides that flexibility of being able to work both in the UN space, which is what I used to do a lot of work in previous phases of my career, as well as being able to work here locally. I'm a big fan of being able to work in the community that I'm living in to be able to help the transition in the places where I am based, as well as then being able to work with the most climate vulnerable, particularly in the Pacific Islands, where I've done a lot of work in my career.
I want to talk about the Pacific Islands, but before I get there, that was I was doing a little bit of research on you, of course, before the podcast. And, you know, you talked about some of your strengths, finance, strategic thinking, as we talked about, climate risk management. But this coastal zone management, you've written down, and that, talk about how you're using that in the Southern California environs.
Yeah, thanks, Ted. So that's where I started. I mean, I'm a geologist underneath. It was my first degree. And then back then, when I graduated as an undergraduate, you really had a couple of choices. Either you went to dig things, drill things, or talk about digging or drilling things. And so I chose to go and do a PhD in sedimentology of how coasts work, with a view of then going into the oil and gas industry, because sedimentary basins are where oil and gas are trapped. And so I was heading into that space. Now, what happened was I interviewed with this was at the University of East Anglia in the UK. I interviewed with a couple of oil and gas firms. At the same time, offered a postdoc in doing the first climate change impact assessment of the UK coastline. And that was one of my major forks in the road, was like, how can I possibly go and work in the hydrocarbon industry when even then, back then, in the late 80s, it was really clear that the direction of impact on coasts from sea level rise, change in storminess, and a whole bunch of other factors was going to accelerate coastal erosion, coastal flooding in those places where those impacts are already being felt, like the east coast of the UK, where I did my PhD, and also in other parts of the world that haven't been experiencing those impacts because of geological stability. But then we're going to change. Then we're going to kick from effectively a stability sort of phase of being able to weather storms, if you like, and bounce back, to not being able to weather storms and not being able to bounce back. And that systemic shift was something that required proactive management, proactive governance, community buy-in, understanding from a policy perspective exactly what the changes could be, and to be able to drive systemic change in a way that's cost-effective, equitable, and deals with short-term issues as well as thinking about long-term change. And so those issues of actually how you deal with complexity around the coast, which has its own unique issues with the sense that actually going down the coast, literally down the beach, is one of the biggest geographic boundaries in the world, right? Geographically, in terms of where land and ocean meets, but it's also got governance challenges. There are different agencies all mixed up in that space. So those challenges of complex governance, chronic challenges, how you deal with issues through multiple stakeholder groups and multiple interests that manifest themselves perhaps the most strongly on the coast is pretty much everything, right, Ted? It's like I just probably just described every single project that requires a transition. And so coming into the decarb space and the energy space is that's analogous, right? You're looking at effecting a change in a positive way that requires a broad stakeholder constituency to be able to empower that change. That includes regulations, it includes innovation, it includes community engagement, all of those things to be able to move the needle forward.
Let me reel you in a little bit and just ask the sort of the practical question. I never thought about the east coast of England as having a you know, as being particularly threatened or susceptible mm-hmm. to the climate change and sea level rise. I guess not just sea level rise, just all the effects of climate change, mm-hmm. more frequent and ferocious storms. But yeah. Is that particularly threatened, or is it just in the relative scheme of things? It's just every coastal community faces a threat.
Yes. Yeah, so the thing there, Ted, is that it's the east coast of the UK has been sinking geologically. It's from the response of the last ice age, actually, the whole of the UK is basically sort of rebounding and tipping on a sort of on an axis. So the southeast of the UK has been tipping at about a couple of millimeters a year, you know, for thousands of years, 10,000 years, very, very slow rates of change. But the thing is with coastal erosion is sort of really rough rule of thumb is about the erosion is about 100 times the rate of sea level change. So 1 millimeter of sea level change turns into about a meter of erosion per year. Mm. So again, historically, the east coast of the UK, very soft cliffs, very low wetland areas, but the cliffs in particular, very soft glacial material have been eroding away. That material is really important because it gets spread around the east coast. It feeds wetlands, feeds marsh areas. It provides natural buffers for other areas against coastal erosion. So that balance, that fine balance between geological forces and then sea level change, there are all sorts of places around the world that are like that. Ted, in the US, the most famous would be the Louisiana Mississippi Delta region, which again is historically subsiding because of geological factors. Then you put sea level rise on top, and you actually put oil and gas extraction as well that's actually accelerating the subsidence. So it's this sense of net sea level change. You've got the land moving up and down, and then you've got the sea moving up and down. If you've got the land sinking and the sea going up, then obviously the relative change is the kicker.
How interesting. Now let's go to the Pacific Islands, because you have represented, I believe, a number of the islands for the Conference of Parties, the UN mm-hmm. Conference of Parties, including the most recent ones, and it was 4 or 5 times. How does that work? How does Robert Kay, this incredibly charming guy, you know, I don't want to say marshal these islands, that would be a terrible pun, but how do you represent the islands, the Pacific Islands? How does that
work? Yeah, thanks, Ted. So the story there is after, this experience of studying and traveling, starting my own business when I was 26 as a way of being able to travel and do interesting work. I lived in New Zealand, based out of the University of Waikato on the North Island for 2 years in the early 90s. And I was a research contractor there at the university, working actually in Bangladesh, doing sea level rise, coastal impact assessment work, and starting to work in the islands. And I got a job to coordinate. Actually, it was the first really systemic climate change impact assessment in the Pacific Islands back in 91 to 92 in Samoa and Fiji. And I did that with local consultants based up in the islands, Japanese consultants. It was actually funded by the Japanese Environment Agency all the way back then. And that was really the beginning of my engagement with the islands. And the thing about working in the Pacific, Ted, is that you lead with your humility, that the islanders see through BS quicker than I've seen anybody do that. And so you just like, look, what can I do? What with what I bring into this, into working with you, helping to understand the challenges that you have and how you can then overcome those challenges then by working with financing institutions or by, again, empowering a community to actually understand what the potential changes are so that, again, changes can then be worked through at a community level. So I've been working all across the islands since the early 90s. And that led in, it was probably the late aughts, I guess, to working in Tonga in particular. I was working in Fiji and other countries as well, and Vanuatu and Kiribati. I was spending a lot of time in Kiribati, which is spelled Kiribati, which is 3 hours on a plane straight up from Fiji, the atoll countries, and Tuvalu also, which is another atoll country, working on a range of projects for various organizations, designing projects, working collaboratively with communities to actually understand vulnerability. And it was through that process, Ted, of actually having discussions with the negotiators in the Pacific Island negotiators about what I could do. Is there anything I can do to help to work through this process? And that turned into invitations from Pacific delegations to help out with the adaptation financing component, very niche component, leading into the Paris Agreement, actually. And I helped to bring folks together, and then it was really one of the highlights, privileges of my career to be part of the Tongan delegation at Paris. I still vividly remember the moments where we were actually editing the paragraphs. It was like I just had this laser focus on a very small number of paragraphs to actually help the text to get through. The thing I'm particularly proud of in working with the islanders is being able to provide forums for the islanders to resonate their own voices. There's one story that still actually brings a tear to my eye when I think about it, was all the way back it was 2009, leading up to the Copenhagen COP, which was the big failure. Yeah. It was the big geopolitical failure, because the science at that point was really clear. It was this IPCC assessment report had come out. Remember, Ted, it was like, yeah, right, yeah, this is it. This is it now. And that I'd help fundraise some money actually from the Australian government to send a delegation of islanders to, including a youth delegation, to that COP. And there was one young climate activist at the time who was really quite nervous about her role. And I spoke with her. It was actually on the plane leaving Kiribati, and basically said to her, said, look, you know, you have a quiet voice, but a powerful message. You know, please just remember that you're going to be full of all sorts. You're going to be around all sorts of people who appear really confident and really, understanding of the fact that there are around thousands of people. I said, just remember that people want to hear what you have to say. And I remember seeing her in the office my next trip to Kiribati. So you got to picture the scene too, Ted. You know, you're not wearing shoes, you're wearing shorts and a t-shirt. You're in the office, and she came by to tell me a story of the fact that she was in this huge auditorium, and just remembered that and said and got the courage up to actually bring her voice forward, and was subsequently led up to the front, to the dais. She was then part of the closing ceremony, part of the closing press conference. Now that was a little sort of seed that I was helped plant for her. So it's not this, you know.
And it was well beyond this raising money for adaptation, like you're saying. The message, the huge message that resounded around the world, that were flooding out a lot of countries, right? I mean, this is an extreme situation. As you said, by the time Copenhagen came around, everybody realized that, yes, we were well past 350 in parts per million as we started off our conversation. I wanted to interrupt this incredible flow, because I'm just so fascinated by how you got to be where you are. Just a very simple question. You grew up where?
Oh, I grew up in Yorkshire, in the north of England.
And what did your parents do? I mean, I'm just wondering, like, how did you, what kind of an influence did you have to be this globetrotter, this humble globetrotter working with all these different countries? What did they do?
Thanks for saying that, Ted. My dad was an engineer, electrical engineer, worked for the local electricity utility. My mum, a homemaker, and also worked in market research. She was actually running the field operations for basically interviewing folks on sort of consumer goods. And I was the youngest of three kids. And we used to, my parents are huge hikers. And so we used to get bundled up in the car on the weekend and go off into the Yorkshire Dales and the North York Moors and the Lake District, all over Northern England. And so it was that sort of love of the outdoors that really got me into the space, together with just deep curiosity, right? Yeah.
Maybe that led to the geology, one of the natural sciences. And like you said, that led to the oil and gas, the sedimentary situation in oil and gas. And then you had this huge pivot.
and then it was also a sense of exploration. I always feel like I'm exploring. I love to go to different places physically. I also like to, you know, explore in my mind and you know, read fiction and read what's going on, both in the field but also in all sorts of different aspects. I try and like to, you know, keep my sort of diet of information very eclectic, just to
very,
make sure.
Very, very inquisitive. And I remember, I first met you when we were bicycling with Jonathan Parfrey, our great friend, mutual friend, and these epic bike rides, these huge bike rides. But you had your folding bike, and you talked about how when you traveled, I had a question right here for you. Are you still traveling with your folding bike?
Yes, I do.
So what a great way to get into a country and be able to get out of the hotel or wherever you're staying and get at least a quick glimpse of what's going on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love that. Thank you, Ted. It also comes into play when I go to the cops, actually. So you don't have to use a local transportation system. It was particularly useful a couple of years ago in Egypt, actually, to get around at Sharm. But yeah, I love doing that. Getting out, particularly in the islands, it's so helpful. Just to be able to pop your bike up.
It sounds a little bit dangerous, probably, to the average listener here. When you go to Egypt and you start bicycling around, are you just an extraordinary risk taker, or are there ways of doing this in a safe manner?
Well, the thing is around, particularly around the cops, is that the security is just so insane that it's much safer to actually engage in bicycling during those events, just simply because there's a lot more security around it.
Let's jump back. We have a few more minutes. I want to jump back to your 319 climate and what you're up to, because we talked about these specific island nations, and it sounds like that is ongoing. You have a passion there, and it's heartfelt. It's beyond work. It has got a lot to do with you and who you are. What are some of the other clients or some of the other projects that you're working on right now that you're particularly excited about?
So I'm excited. It's New York Climate Week next week, and I'm heading out on Friday. I'm working for an organization that is asked me to pull together a group of building experts and insurance experts to come together and think about how does the green building movement integrate resilience into the design and construction of buildings in a way that can be beneficial to the insurance industry as well. Because as we know, Ted, the insurance industry is really suffering from the climate transition and trying to figure out new business models of how they're actually going to deal with the climate transition.
And the climate crisis at hand, right? We're having all these major storms and major events right now. So,
right. 100%. That's something I'm excited about, because I've known people who work in the climate insurance space for a long time. I know a bunch of green building folks, again, for a long time, and it's being able to bring those two communities of practice together to engage with each other and have a closed door conversation that we can then publish afterwards as a very small paper that describes those initial conversations with a view of them being able to, again, systemically move practice
Right. It's a big, it's a big step. Like you said, it's a moving practice, but can you give a specific example of how you could use a green building measure to appease an insurer?
Well, that's what we're going to find out.
There's probably some roofing materials that are fireproof and there's structurally sound building practices that are
correct. I mean, you know, if you're going to be building a very low carbon building, you're thinking about the facades, you're thinking about all the material, the roofing materials, as you say.
Yeah.
You're also thinking about, for example, if there is a flood risk, then why would you put all of your electrical panels in the basement?
Right.
So, and if you're electrifying that building because you really want to decarbonize it, right? Yeah. Just think about that. Like, okay, if you're doing that, then you can actually have a win-win. And then if the building does flood, then the impact is significantly reduced. The uptime, the ability of that building to respond is better, and insurance claims are reduced. The tenants get value from that activity. So it's building those win-win loops that mm-hmm. while you're moving into the climate transition, then you can walk and chew gum, right? Rather than just thinking, just got to do resilience on one hand, or we've got to do decarb energy efficiency. You can actually put them together and get beneficial outcomes.
Yeah, the integration. Tell me just a little bit about Climate Week. Tell me a little bit about it. I believe it started in New York, but now I feel like it's gone global, right? There's Climate Week in London, and here in LA we had Climate Week. And
yeah, I went to some great events last week, Ted. It was the first LA Climate Week. The New York Climate Week is anchored by the UN General Assembly. So it's the week after the UN General Assembly. And so it was developed really as a sort of an add-on at that time of like, well, look, everyone's in town, so let's actually start to develop some climate programs. Now, New York Climate Week has gone to another level, Ted. This year, there's over 600 events all over town.
Like, how does one organize their week? You have your event that you're hosting, of course, but how do you figure out of those 600 events what to do?
Well, you have a theme, or at least a couple of themes. I have an insurance resilience theme going on this year. Also, an innovation. An innovation theme, and then you're just open to, like, somebody would say, you know, hey, Ted, you'd find out, and you say, hey, Rob, are you doing anything on X? And I've got a very obsessive planner that I've got on my Excel sheet of exactly where I'm going to be at what time, and I plan it in advance. But the other climate weeks, like Los Angeles Climate Week and London Climate Week and others, they've really emerged organically, Ted, that seeking a need. The LA Climate Week was really focused on activating communities of change, in particularly individuals who want to get into the climate space, the climate transition space, who might be new. So I went to a number of events that were really very energizing. That's actually where I'm getting a lot of my energy from these days, Ted, is from younger climate activists who are like, look, they want to shape their own future. How can you help? How can your generation help us in that transition?
God, that's great. Final question. How do you keep balance in your life? I mean, it sounds like in your work life, you've really gone through a recalibration or realignment here, and it's feeling good. It's feeling good. And you're biking. So there you're getting some health, how's family? What else is going on?
Yeah, thanks, Ted. Yeah, I am. I was out exercising this morning. I try and do yoga and there's something about the cadence of being on a bike that helps me mentally. So yeah, exercising, exploring. I had a great trip up to the Redwood Forests about a month ago, and went to some new stands that I hadn't been to before. It's just incredibly refreshing. So a combination of, like I said, physically exploring places around California, around the West. It's just an incredible place to live, right? And getting out on my bike. Sometimes I just put my bike in the back of the EV and go to a part of town I've never been to before and just explore it. Just experience it. Yeah.
I like what you say about the cadence of biking. I have never heard anybody say that, but I bike probably 3 or 4 times a week. I have a 10-mile loop and I love it, but I never thought about that, but how great. And then in terms of your travels, you are one of the most traveled people I've ever met. I know you got New York for Climate Week, but what's next on the travel schedule?
Well, that's a really good question. I'm actually, I've actually just committed to go to a couple of other events that are to be announced, Ted. So
oh, okay.
To be a little bit coy about those. Yeah, committing to go to COP. I'm also talking to a UN Environment Program about doing some work with them as well, and that might be a little bit more flexible with travel, but. It looks like the next committed work after New York will be going to Azerbaijan to COP29.
How fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time this morning. And thanks for all you're doing, Robert. And you're inspiring. It's amazing.
Oh, thanks, Ted. That's really kind of saying that. Coming from you, you are one of the people that has inspired me since moving to California. So thank you so much for your time.
How fantastic. Have a great day.
Thanks, Ted.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.